I now remember the title of Deborah's book. It was Ghost Hunters, William James and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death, published in 2006, highly recommended by your ancient presenter. As I said earlier, we've had a rash of food safety scandals, a little bit of food terrorism, any amount of revelations about corrupt food and all other forms of food fraud. This doesn't come as any surprise to Deborah, because she's an expert in the history of food fraud and food safety. Deborah Blum is a Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist. We had her on the program a few years ago to talk about her book, The Poisoner's Handbook, and that was about the birth of forensic science in the US. The newie is called The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Crusade for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century. And yes, the story is American, but it has oodles of relevance for us here in Oz. Deborah joins us from Boston. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me back.
Deborah, we tend to look back to the past as an era of food being wholesome, fresh and clean, in contrast to today's mass-produced offerings. But your book tells a very different story. Give us some examples of what was going into food in the late 19th century.
Yes, this was one of the biggest surprises to me when I started doing the research. But if you go back to the late 19th, where food is completely unregulated, of course, you find an insane amount of fakery and also really bizarre additives in food. And so just as some fakery examples, there was brick dust and cinnamon. Tests showed that spices were often 100% adulterated or mixed with other things. So there was dyed sawdust in ground coffee. There was ground gypsum. Gypsum is what we use to make sheetrock and wallboard in flour. not only fakery of ground coffee, but people made molds to make fake coffee beans themselves, and those were often made with dirt and wax, for instance.
I'm looking down your list here. Brown sugar, notoriously spiked with crushed insects.
And there was this condition called grocer's itch because not all of them were crushed enough.
And I see that borax was common in foods from, bacon, margarine, etc.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? So if you've ever been in your grocery store in the cleaning section and seen 20 Mule Team borax, that's exactly what we're talking about. And that was the other thing about this sort of carnival of unregulated food, is you could put any old industrial chemical, and in the late 19th, there were a lot of them, into food to hide a problem or preserve it or spike up the color. And so you got preservatives like borax and salicylic acid, which we know from aspirin, and formaldehyde, which was had been discovered during wars to be a very good producer of rotting material. And it went into milk and to meat in particular.
I think we should remind the listener that formaldehyde had a significant role as an embalming fluid.
That's exactly right. And that was what, in the weirdest way, made food producers go, hey, this is a great embalmer of corpses. What about roast beef, right? And they actually did it.
Let's look at milk, because as you point out, things were particularly unpleasant with milk. Dairymen in major US cities would water it down to a quite spectacular extent.
Yes, milk is a kind of a case study in how bad food was at this time to me. So dairymen would water it. You know, obviously all of the things we're talking about are profit driven. Dairymen would thin out the milk with water. It didn't even have to be clean water. There was one case in the upper Midwest of the United States where they discovered worms in the milk and then realized the dairyman had just used pond water. There and then they would recolor it with plaster dust or chalk, and then they would re-thicken it, maybe with a little gelatin, and then sometimes to fake the look of the cream, which had been skimmed out, they would puree calf brains and float this kind of yellow mass on the top, which looked a lot like cream. And then, of course, the most popular preservative with milk at the time was formaldehyde. Apparently, I haven't tried it, but formaldehyde, it has a kind of sweetish taste. And so you could pour it into slightly sour milk and kind of recover the fresh taste while preserving it. And there were outbreaks. You see these newspaper headlines about embalmed milk, which is just a fascinating name for it. But it also tells you that why is it in the newspaper? Because the embalmed milk, the formaldehyde-laced milk, was making people sick or in some cases killing children.
You point out it was so commonplace to adulterate food that very often manufacturers didn't even bother hiding it. And, for example, openly advertised Freezine.
Yes, that was a formaldehyde formula that you could use to, I'm putting air quotes around this if you could see me, you could use to improve your meat. And these ads actually would say, you know, use a Freezine and then you can leave your milk out on the butcher counter for a couple of weeks. And there were others with dairy that actually said, and your, you know, happy customers will be able to leave a bottle of milk on the counter for up to 10 days without decomposition. So these products were eerily embalmed, right? And it was completely legal. This is before any food safety or consumer protection legislation. So you can do whatever you want. And not only that, the sort of correlator that is, you don't have to tell people. There's no labeling requirements. So you can put all of these things in food and keep it a complete secret from the person who's going to eat it.
Now, of course, we're talking of a time when a great many people were had moved into or were living in cities. And, of course, it was very early days for respectable preservation.
That's right. I mean, this is the late 19th century. And we, like I said, had, or as you said, had this kind of myth of this time as being all pink-cheeked and healthy. But at this time, one of the things that happens is you see a migration from rural areas and farm towns into cities where there's a lot of work. And so a lot of these products were aimed at urban centers. And back on the farm, you might really be getting, you know, farm fresh materials. But in the city, you were getting these manufactured products. This is the rise of manufactured food as well. And a lot of these people who were working in the city didn't have very much money. And you see this typically with this kind of cheating. The target is the working class and blue collar workers and people who are trying to stretch a dollar. Again, if you have a lot of money, you know, you're not buying this super cheap coffee, right, or whatever, or this watered-down milk. You're getting it from your personal farm or whatever. And so, really, this is one of the things that some of the food advocates that I'm writing about bring up. Once again, this is a predatory kind of action against people who are just trying to stretch a dollar and make their living go as well as it can.
Deborah, lots of villains, but we have a hero. Tell us about Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley.
Yes, that's a great segue into Wiley, who is really forgotten today, but at the time, right around the late 19th and early 20th centuries, was internationally known. He had requests from governments around the world to consult, and he was the crusader who's at the heart of my story who got this change. He was a chemist. I'm very fond of chemists, as you know from Poisoner's Handbook, and he was at the U.S. Department of Agriculture in the late 19th century. And in the late 19th in the U.S., there was no, as I said, consumer protection legislation. So the only agency in the U.S. government that is looking at food at all is the Department of Agriculture. And until Wiley went to work there as chief chemist in 1883, they had not really looked at food in terms of quality. They had really focused on how do we, you know, build agribusiness. And he came in with this kind of moral crusade, holy roller attitude about it, in which he said, we're here to make a difference. And we're going to investigate the food supply. And so
it has to be said, he came from a family with very, very idealistic credentials. His dad, in fact, was involved on the so-called Underground Railroad that moved slaves from the south to the north.
That's exactly right. And his father was a evangelical preacher, and he raised all of his children to try to make a difference. I mean, this is an unusual farm family from Indiana in which even the daughters are sent to medical school, right? And the sort of family calling is to go out and make a difference. So Harvey brings that sense of let's improve the world to the USDA, and he picks, to the great dismay of the manufacturing community, food and drink as his sort of mission in life. I am going to improve this. And he starts with investigations. So those investigations are the reason I can tell you all these horrible things about food, or one of the reasons anyway. And then he goes on to say, you know, it's not enough just to know this. He does push for labeling. At least consumers should know what they're getting. But he said, we have to change this. We have to fix this. That's no longer acceptable to just say, well, you know, let the businessmen figure this out, but of course in a profitable way. And he does become a real scientist activist.
Well, he was very good at it, wasn't he? He comes up with the poison squad. And I understand that there were songs and musical numbers about poisons in food. The song of the poison squad was performed at minstrel shows, and Harvey Washington Wiley became a folk hero.
That's actually a brilliant point, because the Poison Squad, which is a truly off the charts weird public health experiment, also was seen as him as a way to, you know, inform the public and make people realize what was going on. So he had a kind of double plan when he did this experiment. And the Poison Squad was a newspaper nickname for some tests he ran for a couple of years, in which he skipped all animal safety testing and persuaded young government employees to dine really dangerously. And he made a kind of bargain with them. We'll give you 3 free, wonderful meals a day cooked by a professional chef and using the famous farm fresh ingredients. But half of you at any given moment during this period are going to be adding capsules with a chemical additive of some kind that I want to try to study and figure out if it has health effects. So you've got this group, a couple dozen young men, they're sitting at different tables. Half of them are just eating lovely food, and half of them are eating the same lovely food, but adding a capsule with formaldehyde in it, or borax, or salicylic acid, or the heavy metal copper sulfate, which was used to green vegetables. And he had a whole list of these guys. And he tests them to see what happens when they're eating these additives at, you know, very carefully measured doses.
Deborah, France had Jacques from Emile Zola. America, of course, had The Jungle from Upton Sinclair. I recently reread it. You know, I'm an old lefty from way back, and Sinclair was and remains a hero. So Sinclair becomes, if you like, a co-conspirator with Wiley.
That's exactly right. And his timing is absolutely fantastic, because Wiley's Poison Squad studies received nationwide attention starting in about 1903, really, and going into 1905. And in 1906, Upton Sinclair publishes this novel of, Upton Sinclair was a socialist, and he was very interested in the plight of the American worker, and he publishes a novel called The Jungle about the life of immigrant meat packing workers. They work for the meat manufacturers, packing houses in Chicago. And to do it, this is what makes it so amazing to me. And I say this as someone who is a longtime investigative journalist. He actually, although he's a novelist, acts like an investigative journalist, goes to Chicago, lives in a settlement house, which was where homes provided to very poor people, and mingles with the stock workers and spends weeks actually taking notes about what things are like. So when he publishes this novel, it is, in fact, this very dramatic story of the really horrific kind of soul-crushing conditions of work in the stockyards.
Well, I don't think America would see such a crusading novel again until Steinbeck wrote Grapes of Wrath. For example, he describes the slaughterhouses putting out poisoned bread to discourage rats, and then the rats, the bread and meat would go into the hoppers together. Little wonder there was a public outcry which led to reforms including the Meat Inspection Act.
That's exactly right. The Jungle, because it was researched, because his facts were actually solid, sparked a national scandal. You know, this was nothing he spun up as a fairy tale. He had been there. And it became an international bestseller. Countries in Europe started canceling their meat contracts with the United States. There was an enormous angry outcry that built on all the outcries that had been building. And so The Jungle leads to the passage of the Meat Inspection Act. And in that tidal wave of consumer fury and pressure on government, it also leads to the Food and Drug Act. The 1906 Food and Drug Act passed about a week after the Meat Inspection Act. And now, for the first time in American history, you have the entry of consumer protection.
Deborah, all this campaigning makes The Good Doctor very popular. But, of course, he was despised by the food manufacturers. And I was, I was astonished to find that Monsanto comes into the story. Monsanto is still monstrously powerful in the news right now for the problematic Roundup, but they really went for Wiley, didn't they?
They did. I loved finding the sort of origin story of Monsanto as a producer of artificial sweeteners and other, you know, kind of industrial-made additives for foods. And Monsanto was among many both food, drink, and chemical companies that hated Wiley, hated him. With genuine passion, they would plant fake stories about him. Speaking of fake news, fake stories about him in newspapers. They would, you know, drum up different efforts to get him fired. And they did very nearly get him fired by having sort of friendly allies planted in the U.S. government looking for conspiracies, ginning up conspiracies against him.
And, Deborah, we've seen any number of cases recently where, you know, lobbyist companies, corporations have been working very successfully to get Trump to deregulate all over the place. But I didn't realize that Theodore Roosevelt was also unenthusiastic about regulation, particularly for food.
Yes, food was not his thing. I mean, he was very famously a trust buster with some of the big octopus-like companies or trusts, and he really did care about regulating the railroads, but he was kind of forced into food. And I have always been a big fan of the progressive Theodore Roosevelt. And I was really ticked off at him, right? I was slightly disillusioned because I had always imagined him, you know, keeping all business at arm's length. And with food, it's very easy, and drink, it's very easy to realize that on the one hand, publicly, he is this shining light of a progressive crusader. And on the other hand, behind the scenes, he's working with business to make sure that these regulations don't, you know, affect them too drastically or do too much harm to their income stream. And you see him doing, especially with Wiley, you know, creating secret boards to countermand some of his ideas and rulings as they try to get the law in place and actually literally working with people who weaken the regulations. So, you know, he was a far more complicated progressive leader than I had appreciated.
So Wiley resigns in 1912, but he takes over the labs at the Good Housekeeping Institute. And you report he continued making waves until his death.
He did. You know, he was a genuinely, he was obsessed, but he was also a natural crusader. And in some ways, the being at Good Housekeeping, the women's magazines of the early 20th century were also very crusading, right? Ladies' Home Journal published some of the biggest exposés of fake medicine in the United States, and Good Housekeeping also had that kind of mantle. Then he went over there, he created the Good Housekeeping laboratories, he safety tested products, he wrote about them when they were shams, he fought throughout the rest of his career for better regulation of food and drugs. He was very active, actually, even in the 1920s and helping to fight back legislation in Congress, which would have further weakened the rules. He was not satisfied. You know, he wrote a book the year before he died called The History of the Crime Against the Food Law, which is a really bad book, but it's a wonderful kind of, I say as person, one of the few people who's read it today, but you know, it's just this mess of outrage, but it's got all this fabulous evidence of different moments from the passage of the Food and Drug Law until that time of Congress moving to weaken the regulations or cozy relationships between business and legislators. I mean, it's a fascinating book.
If someone goes into a supermarket now, running out of time, but they're confronted by endless lists of chemicals on. But it seems to me that's another form of obfuscation. Those sort of printouts conceal as much as they reveal.
Yes, that's a very good point. And I found myself, you know, food is a lot better than it was in the wild, unregulated days of the 19th century, but is it as safe? Is it as meticulously regulated as we'd like it to be? It isn't. And labels actually provide some really interesting examples of that, because they do, in fact, flood you with information you don't understand. And
which is absolutely useless. Look, we've got to wind it up, Deborah. Deborah Bum's book is called The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Crusade for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century, and it's published by Penguin Press. As I said, incredibly relevant to what's going on in Australia. Thank you very much, Deborah. Ellie Nell on RN.